I think just a mindset of like, if you say you're gonna do something, do it. Like, it's not really, you're not gonna, there's no point in complaining about shit. Like, when you sign up to do something, you go and you execute and you do it. And I, for me, that's what she demonstrated. Just, my mom has never talked about any of those things. It's like, but she decided to be a mother and that was the job and she did it. And it's like, that's pretty cool, mom.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Basketball Strong Podcast. I'm Tim DeFrancesco, former LA Lakers strength and conditioning coach and doctor of physical therapy, and I'm here with my co-host, Emmy-nominated writer and author, Phil White. This podcast is not just for basketball junkies. It's for anyone who loves to hear the human stories behind great people while learning the science behind preparing your body for the court and high performance. Today's guest is Dr. Ramsey Nijem. Ramsey is the Director of Sports Performance for the University of Kansas Men's Basketball Program, who he helped lead to the 2021 NCAA National Title. You can follow Ramsey on Instagram at dr.ramsey.nijem. That's at dr.ramsey.nijem. And you can learn about his highly acclaimed APCC, Applied Performance Coach Certification, at appliedperformancecoach.com. This is such a rich resource for any strength and conditioning coach looking to level up and understand how to better apply strength and conditioning to elite sport athletes. You won't want to miss this. In this episode, Ramsey tells us how he went from setting aside his dreams of playing in the NBA to becoming one of the youngest strength coaches in the NBA with the Sacramento Kings. And then from there, how he went on to become the Director of Sports Performance for Kansas Men's Basketball. His journey is quite inspiring, to say the least. Let's get into the conversation. Ram, I can't wait to have you share with us all your insights on how you help players and hoopers dominate, turn into monsters on the court. But before we get to that, I am just getting caught up here on the fact that you tried to walk onto the UC Santa Barbara hoops team. Tell us about that.
Yeah, man, that takes me back a little bit there, but, yeah, I mean, I'm the typical basketball strength coach who wasn't good enough to make it to the NBA. So I find myself surrounded by players who potentially are now. But yeah, did my undergrad at UC Santa Barbara and tried to walk on then, and wasn't good enough to play there. And it was actually one of the coaches that knew a coach at a different school, UC San Diego, and he kind of recommended maybe I transfer because I could probably play there. They were a D2 team at the time, and it was right around there where I realized, like, okay, you're not going to be an NBA player. I should have realized it much earlier, obviously, perhaps when my height didn't surpass 5'9". But, yeah, that was probably, I would say, like, the start of the strength and conditioning stuff, because after that, I kind of realized, okay, well, if you're not going to play basketball for a living, what are you going to do? And I realized you can help basketball players. So that was definitely how it started.
Right, right. Well, I mean, was that because obviously you had poured yourself into getting to that point into the game and kind of preparing yourself as a player. Was that kind of a tough moment, like a tough pill to swallow type of a moment where you had to kind of lick your wounds, or talk to us about how you was it as seamless as you just described, or did you have to go through some stuff there?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, timing wise, it was relatively quick and seamless. I've always felt like I was a logical thinker. And so it was like, well, you maybe can play at a smaller school, maybe transfer, then what? Maybe go overseas at a small program, maybe use that for a master's degree, maybe some money. But, like, you're not going to make real money. It's not going to be a career. And any time wasted down that path for the love of the game, quote unquote, is going to come at the sacrifice of probably career momentum. You know, and we all know many people who would, and to each his own, like, if you love the game enough to want to go do that and play overseas, go ahead. But we all know so many folks that maybe do go that route, and then they end up kind of in their late 20s, if not early 30s, and still haven't found a footing in the actual career. But they could claim that they played pro basketball, right? And it sounds cool, but it's like, well, and that was never me. It wasn't like I wasn't doing it for that. And so to me, it was just a logical decision, like, at some point, you're going to have to get a real job. You might as well start working on that now to maybe get ahead of people earlier. So, yeah, you know, I wouldn't say it was that traumatic of an event in my life. It was pretty quick for me to just switch the gears. It's always hard for you to hang it up, right? It's like, okay,
right.
I'm now a recreational hooper, right? I'm now the guy at the rec center. But it was fine because, you know, I think that in making that decision quickly, it was able to, I was able to kind of segue that into a career pretty quickly.
Love that.
And that actually, I mean, shoots, that was probably around the time where you may not even remember. You think you received a letter from me, and that was right around that time. It's like, okay, maybe you could be in. It was my brother who told me, man, become like a personal trainer, and that turned into strength coach. I sent letters out to every NBA team, and you got back to me. And I remember we met up. I mean, that was probably 2013-ish time.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I was just settling in with the in the weight room in LA with the Lakers, and I definitely remember, and I always felt like we had Josh Bonatol on, and he was a person that got back to me when I was not really a foot in the door, and I always tried to at least say, absolutely, let's sit down, I'll share whatever I can. So that's amazing. That's really great to think back to. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's crazy, moments like that. I remember, you know, it wasn't like you had a job for me, right? But we sat down, I think we grabbed some coffee near the practice facility. And
yeah,
that alone made me feel like I was gaining some momentum with this. And sometimes that's all it takes. You know, I think sometimes we hope it's like a job offer, an internship. But there's, I mean, whether it was a meeting with you, I remember I got a voicemail from Bill Foran. It's like little things that they're just like, man, like I'm on somebody. I don't even know if it means you're on the radar. It's like they returned a phone call. He had coffee with me.
Yes.
At some point, this is going to turn into something.
That's right. You just keep chipping away.
Yeah. You mentioned an aside there that it is really seems to be a fairly pivotal point in your story where your brother had a role in this journey that's now led you to Lawrence, but talk to us a little bit about that and, you know, the personal training route and how that, the early couple of steps with that, and maybe even share this interesting story of a dog and a chain and, and how that, that kind of facilitated this pivot for you.
Yeah, no doubt. And credit to you guys for kind of bringing all those together, because I kind of mentioned pieces of my story in different places. So credit to you guys on the homework done. But yeah, it was right around the time, you know, I'm talking to my brother and telling him, hey, maybe I'm going to transfer. You know, the coach says he can make a call and it's still a good school, so mom will be okay with it. And he was like, why don't you just become a personal trainer? I'm like, huh? What is that? And he's like, you love working out. You love being around the game. Like maybe there's an opportunity there. And so, yeah, I ended up, you know, to the story of kind of a dog in a chain. You need typically $1,000 to get a certification from somebody. Right. And my first certification was from the NASM. And I think it was like $800 with a student discount. And I didn't have $800. And this sounds like a made up story, but I actually had like a necklace that I had lost for like years, I think. And it was literally our dog who found it in the backyard. And I took that chain, a necklace to a pawn shop. They melted it down, gave me, I think it was like $800 to the T, and turned that right into the NASM textbook and study. I remember I read the whole textbook like in 2 weeks and passed a test. And that, I remember just reflecting on that kind of reading period of 2 weeks and thinking, man, if you can read this in 2 weeks and actually enjoy it, maybe this is something you're passionate about. And so yeah, I was able to pass that test, and that kind of is what kicked it off. And that turned into an internship with the UC Santa Barbara athletics program. And then kind of the rest is history, you know, from one internship to the next, to the first job opportunity and all of that. So, but yeah, it started with my older brother kind of pushing me to become a personal trainer. And luckily a dog that found a necklace in a backyard so I could find the money for the first certification.
That's crazy. That necklace paid off, man.
No doubt it did. No doubt it did. I owe that dog some returns on that.
Oh my gosh. So you mentioned the internship, and you also have, you and I have had conversations where we've all sort of been there, just kind of in the thick of it, in the tunnel, and what you have to do on the front end of that and really put in some pretty crazy hours. Take us into some of those early days and what the days turn to nights, and it all is just one big long day and night.
Yeah, well, shoot, it still feels the same 10 years into this thing, right? But yeah, my first internship was with UC Santa Barbara. And I remember finally landing that a guy you know, Dr. Jeremy Bettle, who
had been
throughout the various leagues, but was in the NBA. He was kind of my first mentor. He gave me my first internship. And that came about because I would walk in to their facility. He was the director of performance for UC Santa Barbara at the time. And literally where the campus was and my house was, right in the middle, was the D1 athletics facility. And so I was walking by every day, and I would just walk in and just say, hey, I sent you guys an email, just wondering if I could, you know, help out in any way. And he's like, oh, yeah, we'll get back to you. And I must have walked in 10 or 12 times. I don't know. And eventually, I think he just realized, like, I'm either going to have to say no, like a hard no, or say yes. But pushing this kid around without actually giving him an answer is not working. So I remember he finally says, hey, man, just go sit in the office. So I sit down. He comes. He's like, what do you want? I'm like, I just want to learn. Like, I'll do whatever. I just want to learn. Basically told me to show up the next day and get started. And so he gave me a chance, which, you know, I would say my career started there. So definitely owe him the world for that. And we still stay in touch this day, which is awesome. And obviously, like a year later, he's going to the Brooklyn Nets. He was working with Darren Williams and those guys. And so he leaves, and I'm like, part of me is like, damn, you know, because I was learning a ton from him. I would credit him for kind of pushing me towards the science side of what we do. Mm. Remember, we had all these blue journals in his office, and I'm like, what are these journals? He's like, well, that's research. You know, this isn't, we're just not in here pretending we know what we're doing. We're learning. And he had a PhD, and I remember the day I passed my CSCS, he probably doesn't even remember this. It's funny how people can say things to you just kind of like with some banter, right? Wittingly say something, and those things can sometimes anchor a life point. And I remember I go in one day and I'm like, hey, Jez, I passed the CSCS. It's official. He's like, well, that's nice, man. Congrats, but I'll raise you a PhD. And I'm like, damn. All right. So I was like, well, and I knew at that point I wanted to get a master's degree, but you know, now that I've got a doctorate, it's like, well, maybe that little moment in history is like why I decided to keep going with school. I don't know. But he gave me my shot. So he leaves, and you know, part of me is excited for him, and maybe in part excited because maybe that means I have somebody that I can lean on in the NBA. But also like, well, damn, like who am I going to learn from? Is the next person going to come in and fire me? Like, do I have a chance to grow still? And, you know, like I always say, I've been very fortunate in my career. The guy that replaces him is another gentleman, you know, Chip Schaefer.
Chip
Schaefer knows everybody because he was in the league for 30 years. So he walks in and the same thing, you know, he doesn't fire anyone. He lets us all keep our jobs and all of those good things. And at that point, I only had 6 months left because it was the NBA lockout. So it was like January time period. I had about 6 months left, and I'm working out with him every day, and I'm asking him the questions, not the questions that strength coaches ask, the questions that like basketball fans ask, because this guy worked with Kobe and Jordan and Shaq and his Phil Jackson's guy. So I'm in there every day like, all right, let me hear who's better, Kobe or Jordan. Like, let me get.
Yeah.
And I'm asking him those things. And 6 months go by, and I go on to get my master's degree and just stay in touch. And eventually he gave me a chance, you know, to come work with him in Sacramento. And there's a bunch that happens in there. So, you know, we could maybe piece that together later, depending on where this goes. But
no,
I'll pause because I feel like I can get going all day on this stuff. So I'll pause. But that's kind of how it started. It's definitely credit to Jez and then Chip, you know, huge mentors and early people who had my back.
I love the dots that are connecting here because, and just to give some context for anybody, Chip Schaefer was Phil Jackson's athletic trainer with the Bulls. Phil brought him to the Lakers. He became the strength coach of the Lakers. And when Chip left the Lakers, I took over the charge of the weight room in that position. And so same with me, any interaction and overlap I ever got with Chip, he was just so welcoming and open to sharing his insights. But yeah, to your point, he kind of sat in Phil Jackson's pocket for most of his career. And of course, that means that he was one of the athletic trainers or strength coaches with MJ or Kobe most of his career. So some incredible just stories that you must have been able to glean from Chip and also insights and just incredible at the craft with that. But I just love the dots that get connected. One of the things that I think is so important, I don't want to get lost on, is you said 10, 12, who knows, maybe more times you stopped in and just kind of just said hello and asked if there's anything you could do for Jeremy when you were just walking by the facility. And I think it's just such a good example of what it takes and to almost go into the early stage of a career, whatever the field, but especially this one where it's so competitive, it's so tricky and so tough to kind of get the foot in the door, but it's just that persistence chipping away and be almost expect that there's going to be a, hey, sorry, nothing for you right now. Or a couple of those or 11 of those. And so it just, I think really, really important for anybody listening who is trying to figure out and has had one of those. And it's like, oh, okay. Instead of saying, okay, on to the next thing, forget it. Just keep chipping away on it. And I think it's really, really, really credit to you.
Yeah. Well, certainly thank you for that. And I mean, I think I was probably fortunate, you know, I reflect on this a ton because I'm now 32. So I've kind of watched, you know, I think that I was early in my career, technology was very much present.
Yeah.
But we're 10 years in now, and it's like this digital age where people think that they deserve jobs from Instagram DMs. And it's like, yeah, man, I almost wish you didn't have access to that, because it's a filter system. It's easy to sit in your bed and DM every strength coach in the country and expect a return. It's another if you actually had to get in your car and drive somewhere or walk somewhere. I think some of that is
send a letter.
Even send a letter to TD. I mean, that was, you know, that stands out. And maybe that people should go analog. And if they do, you know, suddenly you're a coach and you get a letter out of all these DMs, that's going to stand out, right? Or the kid that just keeps coming by the weight room and bugging you.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, no doubt for sure. I mean, and it's frustrating because, and TD, I'm sure you both are probably similar. And, you know, like I know that I didn't get anywhere in my career without people helping me. Similar to how TD has coffee with me over a decade ago. And it's like, that meant something for me. So I happily try to return that favor when possible. But in the digital age, with instant access to almost anybody, it's like people are, I think, losing respect of other people's time and all of those. And I get so many, I won't go off on this, but I can. It's like so many people DM me and they'll say, coach, I know you're busy, but, and then it's like seven paragraphs. Right. And I'm like, well, if you knew I was busy, why would you send me seven? And you know, so anyways, I think that there is benefit to the digital age we find ourselves in. And there's certainly some downsides, and obviously filled with Unplugged, you probably can spend hours even on that alone. So, but yeah, I think there was an effort level required to walk into a facility and basically get kind of the runaround for weeks until I was able to land something.
That's so good. So I want you to just connect a few more of the dots of how, what took you from that into your first NBA weight room, and then, you know, tell us what was it what you expected when you got into an NBA weight room, but connect those dots, how you got to walk your first foot into an NBA weight room and coach NBA players.
Yeah. So I leave UC Santa Barbara to go get a master's degree at Cal State Fullerton. And to me, one of the better kinesiology programs in the country with their sport performance department. And obviously we talked about Dr. Galpin, but everyone else that's there. And Chip happens to live in Orange County. Right. So he's in Orange County. I'm going to do my master's. So we're able to meet for lunch occasionally and just stay connected through that. And a few months later, I end up basically having lunch and going to a game during the winter break of kind of my schooling. And Chip is now hired in Sacramento. And the way
with that the Kings. Came
with the Kings. Yeah. So, and there's, I guess, one kind of little year in between there. After my master's, I was able to go back to Santa Barbara City College.
Got it.
And I ran a strength and conditioning program there, which was amazing. My first job out of a graduate program, I get handed 17 teams. We have an outdoor weight room. It looks like a CrossFit. It's like crazy. And I had a few job opportunities, none of them big, you know, I would say big roles. And I remember the athletic director at the time, and I still stay in touch with him. And his name is Ryan Byrne. And he was the youngest athletic director in California City College or whatever. So a young guy, passionate guy, building a whole bunch of facilities, but built this outdoor weight room. And I was obviously used to Santa Barbara because I did my undergrad there. And I was able to do my undergrad in 3 years and my master's in 1 year. And wow. So as we connect the dots to that first job, I was 23 as an assistant in the NBA, but part of it was getting through school pretty quickly. And I just remember the passion. Like, I'll tell this story only because I think it helps listeners. Maybe like there's a passion that we all have, and it's almost like a sales tactic your passion could become. And Ryan is the athletic director called. I go out, I interview, I thought it went well. He called me a few hours later. This is like a Friday. He calls me at maybe a 3 p.m. I think he interviewed at noon. And he says, hey, man, we went through the process and you impressed everyone here. And we definitely want to bring you on. And I said, hey, Ryan, thank you. I appreciate that. If you don't mind, give me the weekend and I'll get back to you first thing Monday morning with a hard yes or no. I don't want to waste your time. He said, all right, sounds good. We'll respect that. We'll talk to you Monday. He calls me like 2 hours later. He's like, hey, man, I've been thinking about this. We don't need to wait till Monday. You're our guy. We're building this. We're building something special, and we know you're our guy, and I think that you should sign up. And I remember being on the phone, and I'm like, you know what? I'm in, man. Like, if you're
wow.
I'm in. And so I returned to Santa Barbara to run that. As I'm doing that, right down the street is a place called P3, which you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And they work with a lot of basketball players, obviously. So from 2013 to 2014, I'm working at Santa Barbara City College in P3, going back and forth. And Chip had since left UC Santa Barbara to go to the Sacramento Kings to bring a few names in. They did their training camp at UC Santa Barbara. I mean, this is how the world works. It's just crazy how things start to piece together. Sacramento Kings happened to do their training camp in Santa Barbara. And Daniel Shapiro, who obviously, you know, had just left Sacramento.
Sure.
So they needed a strength coach. So Chip is just kind of in there helping them out a little bit and says, hey, who's your strength coach? And Pete Youngman, who's another mentor of mine, tells him, hey, we're interviewing some guys, but we don't have anyone yet. And Chip's like, well, if you don't find anyone, I'll do it. Pete's like, are you serious? And Chip's like, yeah. So I think they probably just verbally agreed in that moment. Like,
right.
I mean, when you have 11 NBA rings, you typically don't interview anymore for roles.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 You can bypass some steps.
Yeah, for sure. So Chip ends up going to Sacramento. I'm in Santa Barbara working at these two places, starting my doctorate at the time, just kind of grinding away. Right. And Chip calls me and he says, hey, man, they're starting to have conversations about bringing on an assistant. Would you be interested? Like, hell yeah, I'd be interested. and you fast forward towards the end of the year, I end up interviewing and all those things, and then Chip brings me on. So it happened pretty quickly. I mean, there was only a 2-year period from I finished my undergrad in 2012, and in 2014, I was hired as an assistant in the NBA. And in those 2 years, I completed a master's and then gained a year of in-depth experience, but certainly not NBA experience. So,
so you went from Santa Barbara City College to with outdoor weight room, CrossFit style setup, into the Sacramento weight room as an assistant strength coach, and that's incredible. So I just know my first take. I'm picturing like my first week on the job, and I didn't have a case where I kind of came in and settled in as a assistant and got to see the lay of the land and follow through. I just came into the NBA and there I was, head strength coach. So I just know at the end of my first week, I'm like, I didn't think this is crazy. This is a different animal. Tell us about what it's like when you first step in and you see what happens in an NBA weight room and some of the unique aspects of that.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I remember my first experience, Chip was out of town because I interviewed at Summer League. And then, as you know, after Summer League, guys try to get vacations in and family time before, you know, early September, people start coming back to town. And so Chip was out of town and he calls me and he said, hey, you know, you're going to start on Monday. And around noon on Monday, DeMarcus Cousins is coming in and you'll be there with him. And I'm like, I wish I could make this stuff up. Like, here's a franchise player.
Right.
With a reputation. And
yeah. Yeah, to say the least.
Coach that he doesn't even know. And I'm like, going to run this session. So I'm like, yeah, Chip, whatever you need.
I got you.
Yeah. And he said, well, I'm going to send you the program and we'll just go from there. So he sends me what is needed to be done and we lock in on that. And here come walking in is DeMarcus Cousins. And I'm like, oh, shit, here we go. And but it was actually a very pleasant experience. Like, I remember thinking, like, that was cool. Like, I really enjoyed that. And there was so much, I was nervous. I'm like, don't say the thing, as you can imagine. And it went really well. And I remember just as he walked away, I felt, you're always excited for the role, but like early in a role, especially before you start, like the day you land a job, there's like excitement and anxiety. And I think after that session, it was more excitement than anxiety. And so from there, just kind of you roll into a training camp and all those. And you start to realize like this thing is a machine. It's not just people working out. It's like, there's a whole flow to this. There's a whole process. There's chefs involved. There's assistant coaches, player development coaches involved. There's treatments involved with trainers and there's PTs and there's I mean, there's like a million moving parts in here. You're not just a strength right. and a workouts anymore. And that was, I think, the biggest difference. At Santa Barbara City Coast, I did whatever the hell I wanted. I wrote programs. And I would say the risk wasn't that big. Like,
sure.
Whether it's beneficial or a risky movement, it's almost like you're a community college player. Like, you're probably not going to the NBA anyways.
Right, right.
And now there's like 15 people involved in almost every decision you're making for a guy. So, yeah, it was definitely a whirlwind experience those first few months. But you settle in over time and then you get comfortable and then hopefully eventually you start to do a good job. So that was kind of the flow.
Love that.
And something that a lot of people may not know about that time, obviously we'll get more into how that assistant role played out. And we sure want to hear some Chip stories and what you learned from him, you know, kind of sitting at his right hand rather than just meeting for coffee, you know, now and again in that interim year. But you're doing a double doctorate. Let's get greedy now, right? So Jez one-ups you with one, and you decide, I'm thinking, all right, Jez, how about two? Then how are you going to one-up that? But not only is it a double doctorate, but this program can take people 8 years, and sometimes this is all they're doing, you know, or maybe they're working a part-time job at the time. But you decide, okay, I'm going to knock this thing off in four. So double the work, half the time. To trace this back, I've got to think that maybe your mom's example comes into play here, and maybe something genetic or just that you observed in her this hard work ethic. Can you kind of connect the dots a little bit between your kind of origin story and growing up as you did and where this just relentless desire comes? Because a lot of people get in the NBA, I've got to guess, and you know, they're everything's going on, as TD has shared many times in here, and they just be happy with that. But you double down, and in this case, double down and then half the time. So can you maybe share a little bit about how her influence may have impacted this work ethic you developed?
Well, yeah, of course. And thank you for asking that, because I feel like I actually never tell that side of any of it. And sometimes I think I probably use the word passion a lot more than is probably right, because most of it is probably just hard work from my mom. I grew up with, my mom's a single parent and she raised me. I have a twin brother. We're nothing alike, but I have a twin brother and I have an older brother. So she raised three sons on her own. Wow. And everything that went into that, and had two jobs, like just to put food on the table, work extremely long. I mean, 14-hour days were normal for her. On a half day, on a Sunday, she would come home, say hello, and then go to a second job. And it's like those things. So to me, when I think of like hard work, and we all say we grind and all these things, it's like, that, do I really work hard? I sit in my office and I read and I write and I email. And then I'm fortunate to go to work with NBA players or some of the best college basketball players. Like, it's like, yeah, you work hard, but I'm not building homes. This isn't like right. a labor career. Yeah, I mean, credit to my mom, certainly. Both on like the what hard work means, and I think just a mindset of like, if you say you're gonna do something, do it. Like, it's not really, you're not gonna, there's no point in complaining about shit. Like, when you sign up to do something, you go and you execute and you do it. For me, that's what she demonstrated. Just, my mom has never talked about any of those things. It's like, but she decided to be a mother and that was the job and she did it. And it's like, that's pretty cool, mom. So now my mom's like my best friend. She's been to games here at Allen Fieldhouse. She came to games in Sacramento. To kind of tie that, like, there's moments in the NBA that we end up taking for granted when you work in the NBA, and obviously to
absolutely
these things, because at once things settle, they become a job, right? It's like all the little things that you start to complain about, you're like, what are we complaining about? And there'd be times, I remember one time I needed some tickets, and DeMarcus Cousins out on the weight room floor. And I'm like, yo, big fella, man, I need some tickets tonight. Because as an assistant, you don't always get tickets. It may have changed now, but back in the day, it was like, if you were the head strength coach, you typically got two tickets. But if you're the assistant, someone's got to look out for you.
Sure.
And obviously, Chip would always look out for me, but I needed some tickets. And I'm like, big fella, I need some tickets. I got mom's coming, man. It's going to be our first game. And he's like, oh, okay, man, I got you, man. Just tell. And he had his manager that we all knew. He's like, just text him and tell him whatever name and you good. I said, all right, bet. Well, the game starts, and I see my mom walking down on the court.
No.
And I'm like, and I tell high car security, I said, yo, that's mom's, but she must be lost. They ushered her down the front row, put her right on the floor, feet on the floor.
No.
And I'm like, yo, big fella, like, you did that? He said, I told you I got you, fam.
Oh.
And I'm like, yo, that's such a cool, like, so credit to my mom for sure, but
special.
I try to do everything I can now to try to let her benefit from those things. And so, you know, like in 2 weeks, we have the Applied Performance Summit we're doing in San Diego.
Yeah.
I got a nice Airbnb. My mom's coming down. The family's coming down. Like, so yeah, credit to her for sure. But she, you know, it's funny because there's people who work hard and then they tell the world that they grind. And there's actually people who just work hard and they shut up and do the work. And my mom is certainly that. Like, she just did the work. And yeah, probably taught me more about life than she'll ever know. And certainly doesn't get enough credit for.
Man, she set the foundation. So, okay, so you roll with the position as the assistant, but at some point that turns into you becoming the youngest head strength coach in the NBA. What's it? Tell us about how that transition happened, but then tell us what it's like going from an assistant strength coach to a head strength coach when all of a sudden it's kind of like the buck stops with you a little bit more.
Yeah, totally different role, right? Totally different role. I mean, it's probably the equivalent of like being a role player versus being, you know, the guy that's got to run the show.
Right.
And so Chip had left back to the Chicago Bulls. And I remember when he called me and he told me that, and obviously excited for him to return back home and obviously kind of return to where it all started for him, full circle, kind of his career.
Yeah.
And I remember after the congratulations and stuff, you got to ask like, hey, Chip, what does that mean for me? Does that mean I'm fired? And he said, well, to be candid, like, I don't know, right? Because he was going to the Chicago Bulls, but they had some strength coaches, so it doesn't mean he's going to walk in and fire them. And the league's not really – you can do those things, but it's not necessarily like that. It's not as – like, you know, in college, if a head coach goes somewhere, it's very common that they're going to bring their people.
Sure.
In sport performance, it's a little different. You know, if a PT goes somewhere, he may not fire everyone and bring his own people in. Like, we're not that high on the totem pole.
Right, right.
And there's so much that would go into that. So, yeah, I remember it was right around the NBA draft workouts were starting right around this time back. This was 2016 now. And I remember I go in the next week and we're running draft workouts. And Pete Youngman, who's now with the G League Ignite as their director of sports medicine, but he was with the Sacramento Kings for 25 years. And I remember I walk in getting ready for the draft workout and he's like, hey, you think you could run this? And I'm like, come on, OG, you know I could run this. All like the inside, I'm like, oh shit, I don't know if I'm ready. I don't know, but like, you can't say that. You got to protect.
Right.
Like, I'll run this shit, OG.
Right.
Like, well, I think you can too, man. So I'm gonna go push for you to make that happen. And I'm like, man, thanks, Pete. Like, you know, that's awesome. I appreciate it.
Wow.
And it's so funny because an hour later, I messed up the whole draft workout. I wouldn't say I messed up the whole draft workout, but I made. I forgot to take every athlete's, and typically they're in groups of like six for these draft workouts, and I forgot to take everyone's wingspan.
Oh, man.
Which is so stupid because it's like the easiest one.
Right.
And so, but I was just so nervous and excited, trying not to mess up. You know, draft workouts are relatively simple things to run, but then you end up basically taking all the data. What we would do is take a report and then hand it out to the 50 people on the sidelines. I mean, you got GMs and all these people. So like your part is very simple, but the process of getting it's going to some high level people. And I remember thinking, oh shit. So what am I going to do? So after the workout, I pulled all the players real kind of like incognito, silently. I said, hey, I need all y'all in this waiting room real quick. Boom. Check them all off. So that way the report at the end of the day, at least had everything that was needed. But I messing up like literally within an hour, I made a big enough mistake for someone that's like, it's not a huge mistake. No one got hurt. Nothing happened. But I would argue it's a big enough mistake for people to question whether or not you actually can run this.
Sure. Because,
and, you know, so I took things like that to heart. But, yeah, I remember I messed that up. And a few months go by because we go through all the draft workouts. And then you go through summer league. And so a lot of these hires sometimes get put on the back burner because developing your roster is more important than hiring a strength coach sometimes. So we had a new coach at the time. Dave Yeager had just come in, so I wasn't sure if he was going to try to bring his own guy. Vlade had just become the full he was the GM for a little bit before, but this was his first full year. It was just a lot of moving parts. So I'm like, I don't know if I'll get this job. And I remember the day that Vlade comes to me and Dave come to me, And Vlade's kind of talking shit and just having a good time. That's who he is, a great person to be around. And he says, well, hey brother, congrats on your new role. And I said, is it official? Like, I'm like, is it official? Because no one told me yet. He's like, well, the GM is telling you that you're the head strength coach, so I think it's official.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, man, so, like, you got to stay calm and cool, right? You're like, ah, right. Thanks, y'all. Thanks, appreciate y'all. I'm excited to work with y'all. I remember going back to my office like, let's go.
Yeah. Turned up. Oh, man, that's amazing. What a story. Yeah,
25 years old and handed that role. And then you got to start the work. I mean, we were moving to a new arena, so I had to build out a whole new weight room. Had to hire an assistant to replace me. I knew it was important to get him paid more because I always felt like I wouldn't say I felt like I was underpaid. I just felt like the position at large should be valued at more than my salary. I'll never say I felt like I was underpaid. I was excited to be in there. I mean, you could have paid me just per diem and I would have figured it out. Like, it wasn't a big deal, but I knew that for us to build this the right way. And then obviously you have salary surveys, TD, you know about those.
Yeah.
So I knew that we were below the average there. So it's like, okay, build a weight room, hire an assistant. Can we start an internship? Let's do that. Do we need a new G League strength coach? That's got to be on the radar. We don't really have sports psych as a consultant. Should that come in? What about nutrition? We don't really have a dietitian. Do we need a consultant there? So I'm just, everything is like, how do you build this high performance, quote unquote, unit while also doing a good job because we're moving to a new weight room and all these things. So that summer was like, I would say, a huge growth opportunity for my career because I've walked into a role that many people would say I was underqualified for, right? Like, I'm open about that. Like,
yeah,
I'm 25 years old. I don't have 10 years of experience at this stuff. But you just punch outside your weight class and imposter syndrome hits and you just keep it rolling. And eventually you look up and you're like, hold on, I'm doing kind of a good job with all this shit right now. So yeah, that was kind of that transition from assistant to head.
And that's a lot. And I mean, I think what I'm interested in to hear next is when the dust starts to settle a little bit, and then it's kind of like, obviously you had this ability to develop some relationship with a lot of these players before as an assistant, so they kind of knew who you were. But even so, I think a lot of people on the outside assume that, well, these are NBA players, they're paid millions, so they must be just flocking to the weight room. They must be lining up to do all the stuff that Ramsey lays out for them and just follow it to a T. Yes, coach, you got it. All this other stuff. And yeah, there's some players that do that, but not all of them. Take us into that a little bit, insider's view of what it's like to kind of get the lay of the land now that the buck does stop with you as the head and the youngest head strength coach in the NBA at the time, and kind of how you navigated that.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. And I was able to learn that lesson over the 2 years as the assistant.
Like, yeah,
not everybody wants to be a high performer.
Right.
The things that we've labeled as a high performance mindset, not everyone has that. And I don't know, that probably means we need to change our definition of high performance mindset.
Right.
Probably a conversation for another time, but
different episode.
Yeah. but I was fortunate because I was the assistant for 2 years. A lot of the players that I was with now as the head already knew who I was. There was a level of respect, familiarity, trust, and relationship. So I didn't feel like, you know, if I was 25 walking into a new team, I think that there's a different level of, you know, guys might try to run over you a little bit. You got to earn more. And because of that, the relationship side, I would say a lot of the guys wanted to work with me even more so as the head, only because they didn't want me to fail. Like, they wanted to have my back. So there'd be times where they probably want to say, like, Ram, we ain't doing that shit today.
Right.
But they would say, like, you know what, Ram, chauffeur's role, man. Come on, let's get it done. And so they really, like, I even had Rudy Gay come up to me and he said, man, you my rook now. I got your back in all this.
I love that.
Yeah, like, my veterans had my back a ton, and I would make mistakes and they would tell me, and they would tell me, hey man, I work with a lot of strength coach. I'm an NBA journeyman. This is what you're doing good. This is where you probably gotta put your foot down a little bit more here. Like, they really helped me learn through that process, which I, you know, appreciate them a ton for, because they could have, you know, went to the GM and said, Ram ain't doing this right, or whatever, right? Like, we know there are guys that act that way. And I've always had good vets that have my back. And so, you know, we were a relatively young team. So there was some benefit there, only in a sense that our younger guys didn't know anything, right? They didn't know that you actually could kind of say no.
And right. You know, like,
they didn't really know that. They were still kind of in a college mindset. And then we had good veterans you know, we weren't very good as a team when I was with the Sacramento Kings. They're great now, as
yeah,
you know, they just lost last night to the Warriors. But there's some pros and cons to that. The cons are obviously you don't win a lot of games.
Yeah.
The pros are that you have young guys, and then the vets that you have are typically pretty good vets because they were brought in to help the young guys develop. They're not veterans like maybe a Chris Paul or some of these other guys that are known to be very good players, right? We had the vets that were more journeymen, were more role players, but they knew their role was to help the young guys.
Yeah.
And in doing that, we ended up with a really good training culture. We didn't have guys complaining about much because the young guys watched the vets, and the vets knew that their role was to make the young guys work. And then I ended up in a position, you know, with Rajon Rondo and DeMarcus Cousins and Rudy Gay all together. And that was actually, you know, we still didn't make the playoffs. We had George Karl coming in. But we now had a veteran presence that was actually well-respected. Rajon Rondo, I loved working with Doe. He's one of the better players I've ever got a chance to work with. An incredible vet. Both taught me how to be a better strength coach. But also, I can lean on him when some of our rookies were bullshitting. I'll say, no, man, Rook kind of playing. He said, and he'll say, bet, watch this. I got you. And I've seen him
really grab
players by the collar. Say, hey, man, hey, strength coach, say, work, you work. Come on, let's go.
Wow.
And he could do that because he was a champion.
That's rare. Yeah, that's rare.
So I just had guys that I think gave me credibility only because they wanted to. They wanted to show love. They didn't have to do those things. I had another rookie who didn't want to get on the scale for whatever reason. You know how guys get in their moods.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, Rook, man, come on, let's get on the scale. And he didn't want to do it. And I go to one of our vets because you can find players.
Yep.
And I always took it personal. I never wanted to find a player. And that was a learning lesson. I eventually ended up finding a player. And I realized that at the time, I hated to do it. To me, if you have to find a player, what I used to think was that it means that you don't have a good enough relationship with this individual. And you need to work on your relationship and not take his money. What I realized after is that some players, not all, but some players will see how far they can push you. And if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And as soon as I find him, he actually respected me more and showed up more.
Wow.
It was such a learning
lesson. Very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I was taking it so personal. Like, this is me. I got to figure out my relationship.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, what you got to do is put your foot down and demand respect. And sometimes that means take their money. It's a lot of money to us. I mean, should I find the dude $2,500 the first time and $5,000 the second time, they don't care.
Right.
But it's enough for them to say, you know what? I got you, Ram. Come on. And so there were some learning lessons there, but I just had these rooks that were like, I mean, these veterans that really, I think, allowed me to learn and all those. So
one thing that I think is really interesting about you is that there's this balance between wanting to get in and do the thing. And, you know, your enthusiasm for that, even with some of these stories you share with us so far, is contagious. But then there's also the perpetual learner. And I love the thing that you gifted yourself when you finished your master's, just to back up to that, was a backpack. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And then also how that kind of, then to catch back up, played into this role of, yes, practitioner with the Kings, but also perpetual learner.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny, when I finished my master's, I think that you envision, I think, the end of certain journeys to be a certain way, right? Like, when I finish my master's, I'm going to be done with school and it's going to feel great.
Mm.
And then you do those things and it's like, and I remember at the time, it was like, when I finished my master's, there was two things I was excited about. I'll be done with school because I had no intention to keep going in school. And then for some reason, like, I've always wanted a BMW. And I was like, I'm going to buy a BMW. And I just fast forward, I still don't have a BMW. So like, but I don't know, like, maybe as a kid growing up, I always thought, like, if you had this car, it meant something. And then I finished my master's and I have a job, but it's not a high paying job. Mm. I'm pursuing the MBA passionately. Still not there. And I just remember sitting there like, well, you don't have enough money for a BMW. So that's a stupid thing to even think about. And the idea of not going to school anymore actually didn't settle well, because I felt like I wasn't learning. Like, it was like, are you done learning for the rest of your life? Like, you're 23 years old. What? How stupid is that, right? It's like, you can't be done learning.
Right.
So then I'm like, you know what? You got to get the backpack, right? Like, you got to get back in that zone. It was like a mindset shift. And then from there, I was like, well, if you're 23 and you're going to keep learning, you might as well get letters for it. And to me, that's what formal education is. Formal education doesn't mean that you're a better learner than anyone. And for the most part, it doesn't mean you're smarter than anyone.
Sure.
All it really means is that you're just going to get formal credit for it. Because for the most part, through YouTube and the rest of the internet, you can learn whatever the hell you want. It's just hard to formally show people that. And so for me, it was like, you know what? If you're going to keep learning passionately, you might as well get formal units and credit for this so that you can put it on a resume.
Mm.
Because there was one thing that, and I still think about this often, is, you know, you can't fast forward time. And a lot of us oftentimes are, especially early in your career, if you're a younger listener on this, you're going to be judged a lot based on your experiences, but you can't fast forward those experiences because time is time. I mean, there's 24 hours in a day. You can't do anything about it. And I always remember feeling like, okay, there's nothing, I can never have 10 years of experience today. Like, if you look at my resume today, you're going to call me inexperienced. And sometimes people equate lack of experience with lack of knowledge. And I'm like, okay, well, if experience is really knowledge, then can you just get a bunch of knowledge? And maybe people will look past the lack of experience. So there was like, it was like a conscious thought, like, okay, there's nothing I can do to fast forward time, but maybe I can get more knowledge faster. And that's probably why I got my undergrad in 3 years. I got my master's in a year, did the doctorate. It was like, I'm going to accelerate knowledge so much that when you look at my resume and you look at me at 25, you're going to see I don't have experience, but maybe you'll still be confident I could do the job. And so that was kind of the whole entire mindset. And I was settled into Santa Barbara I was only there for a year, but my mind was ready to be there for 4 years because I started the doctorate. I knew that I could finish the doctorate in 4 years. I had mapped that out. And I knew that if I was present, if I would be where my feet were and I was present, then I would walk away from this 4 years later with both experience and a doctorate. And if I have both of those, maybe I can apply for jobs. So I was like ready to lock in Santa Barbara. I love Santa Barbara. It hurt my heart to leave, but when the Sacramento Kings call, you got to leave, right?
Right. Right.
But that was kind of the mindset in that moment. It was 2013, and I'm like, you know what? Let's get this thing going. Let's do this right. And I started the doctorate at in May of 2014. And when Chip finally called and kind of mentioned the role, I said, Chip, he offered the role, and I said, I accept. And he's like, well, don't you want to know salary? I said, it doesn't matter. The only thing that I would ask Chip is, do you mind if I finish school? Because I knew that if I got fired or something, I would need that degree.
Yeah.
And Chip was awesome about it. He's like, yeah, of course. And I did my doctorate through a hybrid program. So I had to leave the team. Basically, every few months, I would leave for 4 days.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
No matter where we were. Like, I remember there was a time like we had just played the Celtics. The next morning, I wake up at like 3 a.m., hit the airport, fly out, return. And Chip was great about it. Yeah, that was kind of the mindset, though, starting the doctorate. And I think, you know, it's funny because it's sometimes when we look at like investments of either money, because I paid out of pocket for my schooling, mm-hmm. or investments of time, like the opportunity cost there. But whenever I look back on that, I'm like, did the doctorate pay off? I don't know. But I don't think that Pete would have gave me the head job if I didn't at least finish or had started that. And I was almost done with it at the time. So, you know, that's how I've justified it in my head. It's like it was a lot of money, a lot of time.
Right.
But I don't think I would have got the head role if I wasn't already in that because of what you mentioned earlier, this kind of learner that I was labeled as.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting. And as I hear you say that, is I have this conversation with a lot of entry level professionals, either strength coach, physical therapist, or both, who you know, are considering, do I go the PT route? Do I not? And I'm always the first one to say, look, being a PT didn't, there's tons of strength coaches that are way better at that job than I was, and they don't have a doctorate in physical therapy, but it became a passport for me to be able to separate, differentiate, and have these conversations be held and viewed as credible. When I was a little behind you, but I was 30 when I walked into become the head strength coach of the Lakers. And you know, that's such a good way to put it, is that it kind of offsets when you have these things that at that time you cannot, there's nothing in your control to say, well, I have 15 years of experience in the NBA. Like Gary Vee could say, well, he could say I had 30, you know? And so I couldn't make up for that in years and time. And so that's such a great point. You did your dissertation on the connection between workload and NBA injuries. It's super hot topic in terms of load management and this kind of thing. I want to really dive in on this with you, because I have this sense that a lot of people's perception of what load management is all about is this idea that, well, what happens is the players are playing way too much AAU, they're playing too much basketball, and then all of a sudden they just get this sort of slow breakdown or a big injury because of a slow breakdown, and they play too much, so they get injured, so we have to play them less, and we have to start resting them games. And it's not, I want to hear what your take is. I think that's a flawed perception of what load management should be or could be, or if it's best applied. Take us into it. You're the one that did the dissertation on it.
Yeah. I mean, you're totally right. It's super hot topic. Especially with even Kawhi in these last playoffs.
Sure.
A lot of that stuff. And most people think, I would say 98% of people, even within the NBA at some level, think that workload management means doing less work. They've equated those two. And to me, the word management is like, not to get into semantics, but it's not called workload decline. It's workload management. We're managing something. If you were to manage your finances, it doesn't mean you spend zero money. It just means that you have better decisions around where you spend money and where you save money. Mm. So workload management to me is a gas and a brake. It's not just pulling back. There's times where we got to put the throttle on people. And I don't, you know, I'm not in every conversation in the NBA, so I don't know what the conversations are or the processes are. But in general, workload management is this idea of we need to find a balance, an optimal balance between how much our athletes are doing and then ultimately what's, to me, I look at what they're doing and then what they're going to be expected to do or the demands that they're doing. And we just got to bridge this gap. And if all we do is pull back, the gap will not be bridged. Like, you're just going to have holes in it. So, it's a huge topic in the NBA, rightfully so. But I think one of the issues, like, to me, the punchline is we don't know as much as we think we know, or we certainly don't know as much as people pretend to know. Like, there's a lot we don't know, not only about it's surprising. We don't know a lot about the game of the NBA. Like, there's some research out there that helps, but there's really a lack of data on all sides of things. And some of it is nuanced. Like, for example, the way that people define injuries, the way that people report injuries, where those injuries are actually data-based. Is an athlete actually, like, I mean, down to like, if a player sits because if he's healthy and he sits, they might fine the team. So now, like, we'll label him as injured or something. Or so it's like, maybe he wasn't, they just wanted to pull him back, but they don't want to get fined from the league. So there's so much that goes into it that to me, it's just a huge problem. And I don't even know if we're going to be getting closer to solving it because of all these nuances. There's a ton that goes into it. And for my dissertation, we looked at 4 years of data. We looked at first injury occurrence over those 4 years. And we pulled second spectrum data, which is the camera system above those NBA courts.
Yeah.
And so we were able to create a regression model to quote unquote predict injury. But the regression model wasn't very strong. We had an area under the curve of like 55%, which means that we were slightly better than if you were to sit there and watch TV and flip a coin and predict injuries. We're barely better than that. Not
right.
And we had millions of data points.
Right.
And there's just it's just so nuanced. There's so much that goes into it. So,
So complicated. Yeah. It's so complicated. I think, you know, second spectrum now is getting taken over in the NBA by, is it Hawkeye? A different company, so, you know, who knows with different technology than when you and I were in the league and that kind of stuff. And maybe that's helpful to some extent. But the point you're making is there's so many variables in this overall. It's such a complicated topic. And I mean, so you get this data point and, oh, so-and-so got injured on that. And what happened to his speed and his change of directions and everything we can maybe measure with to the eye or to the camera or whatever it is. But we don't know if also he's going through a huge home at home off court stressor at the time. We don't know if he's nailing his nutrition that whole month going into that or not, or if there's other stuff going on off the court. There's so many pieces from that angle. Predicting, first of all, is just such, it's like catching water. So how do you look at it from the standpoint of, oh, we're gathering this information? Do you look at it as so that we can predict, or do you look at it as, how do you look at it?
Yeah, certainly not predict.
Yeah.
That word is, and I think we're hopefully starting to move away from that word
in
the industry, but I mean, still to this day in professional sports, there's a company every week that emails you or wants to set up a meeting with someone. And for $30,000 a year, they'll predict your injuries. I mean, it's like they all got together and decided that $30,000 a year is the right number for injury prediction.
Yeah.
But it's not working.
Right.
I always say I actually can predict every injury. Like I know how to do that. It's very simple. You can look at a team and you can say every single one of your players will get hurt. And now you will be right, because when players get hurt, you can say, I predicted that he would get hurt. Right. Well, the problem, and this gets into like diagnostics and sensitivity and specificity of diagnostic tools. But just because you say people are going to get hurt, that's not necessarily what we care about. What we care about is how accurate you are. If I say your whole roster is going to get hurt and then three people get hurt throughout the year, you technically predicted injuries at 100% rate. Mm. You just happen to be wrong for everyone else. And so that's one of the bigger issues that we don't think about, especially GMs and the people that sometimes push some of these agendas. It's like, yeah, but you didn't actually look. That's a terrible diagnostic tool. They just said everyone was going to get hurt. And naturally, somebody will get hurt on the roster. So I don't really look at it from a prediction perspective. I look at it from, hey, we're going to gather as much information as we can, as much relevant information as we can, hopefully in a non-invasive way that can be done practically and not piss people off. Because as you know, certain guys don't want to wear certain monitors
and
all that. And then can we use that information because to me that becomes diagnostic. Can we now use this from a treatment or prescription perspective? So how is this information going to influence the treatments? Maybe some stuff that the athletic trainers are going to do, maybe some stuff that the PTs plan to do, maybe some stuff in our weight room. Maybe we start to pair the traditional workload, second spectrum, GPS type units with maybe some of your force plate testing. Maybe you just have like a mood survey. There's like, to me, you want to piece together a system that will ultimately allow me to answer one question. How is this athlete responding to what he is doing?
Mm.
And then based on that, you start to make programs around it. Does it mean that they're going to, you know, never get hurt? Probably not. You know, right. I always reference back to a quote, and I don't even know who deserves credit for this. So someone maybe can Google it, but it's like, ships are safest at harbor, but ships are meant to sail. And to me, our athletes are very much the same. Like, your athletes are safest on the bench. If you don't want them to get hurt, tell them to sit on the bench. Don't play.
Right.
But they want to play.
And so right.
There's a level of acceptance that we have to appreciate and come to agreement in. And it's a risky business. That's what sport is. I mean, at some level, this may sound terrible, but at some level, it's like you're paid $30 million a year to actually go out there and risk some of this stuff. Like, it's part of it.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. And then it's the jobs of people like you, me, when I was in the league and, you know, those great professionals of performance, strength and conditioning. You brought up the rehab side of it, the athletic trainers, the physical therapists. It's their jobs to be able to do the thing that, and this is what I want to really hear you kind of take us through, is because it's like, wait a minute, Ramsey, you just said, there's a hit the gas or you know, push the throttle type of part of load management. I thought load management was if they're tired, give them rest. Take us through why that is a huge error and why, and then how, if you can, give us some examples, like not, you don't have to name names, but like an NBA case example of what, how you as a strength coach would say, okay, this is the time where I'm going to actually, yeah, maybe you're not playing today, but this is what I need you to do. And I'm going to push the throttle in this moment.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, to me, it's, you ultimately want to make sure that what the athlete is being demanded upon in their sport, that they're ready for that.
Mm.
It's pretty much that simple, right? And so it's like, okay, well, how do you do that? Well, in the NBA, you say, well, you play on average 3.5 games per week. So on the high end, it's 4. On the low end, it's 3, just to make it simple. Back when there was a ton of back-to-backs and all that, you used to play 4 games in 5 nights. When you used to do that, you can say, well, you might play 5 games in a week, and then for whatever reason, you might end up with 2 or something like that. So if we know the goal is that we want to match what we're asking you to do to what you're going to be asked to do in your sport, we say, well, we got to prepare you for 4 games in a week. And on this week, we have 2 games. Well, if we only play 2 games this week and we don't do something to supplement that, to get that closer to 4, then when it comes to the next week and you're asked to do four, we have not matched your preparation with the demand. And it's like really that simple, but we really complicate this stuff. And it's like, why are we complicating this? You're going to be asked to do four of these things. You've only done two of these things. We need to ask you to somehow do two more. Okay, well, I don't control the NBA, so I can't make a schedule. I can't have the Detroit Pistons come in and play us. So what can I do? Okay, so now it's like, how do we fill that gap? But what does sport actually look like? Well, there's accelerations and decelerations, and there's jumps and there's cuts. Well, maybe we start to ask you to do those things over here. So that way, when we come to next week, it's very similar. And like, that's all you're doing all of the time. So in that instance, you would want to do more. And then you might say, well, okay, there's five games this week for whatever reason. I remember we had a hamstring strain on a trip when we played, I think, 11 games in like 13 days or something. It was like stupid. This is back when the NBA used to do these things. And I remember when the player tore his hamstring, and we knew he had a hamstring history. We had rehabbed him with us already. All signs of workload, acute chronic ratios, all these things pointed to the red. But we were trying to win a basketball game, and that was part of it. Could we have rested him? Sure. But anytime, like, hindsight is always perfect. So, you know, if you have five games and you have a week coming up where it's like, okay, can we pull back on that? Because that might exceed their capacity that we've built. In general, you would want to prepare your athletes for the worst case scenario. Because then when things like that happen, when a back-to-back happens or overtime games happen, or I don't know, you if you want to get real nitty gritty, it's like, yeah, you played four games, but the four teams you played all played at a higher pace than the average of the league. So now your accelerations are up a little. Like, you can get pretty nitty gritty if you wanted. But in general, just prepare them for the worst case scenario so that when those things come, they've been prepared for them. If you only prepare your athletes for the average, then by definition, they're going to be underprepared for most of the stuff, depending on kind of how you look at average versus median. But in general, average is only average. And we're not preparing for average. We're preparing for worst case. So that's kind of how we looked at it. So a very acute and practical example is if you didn't play 15 minutes in a game for us, you owed us a conditioning session prior to your next basketball workout.
Mm.
It wasn't punishment. It was that you did not do enough in that game to keep you maintained for the demands of the game, because there's a chance next game you'll play 30 minutes.
Right.
So it's very simple. So then it's like, okay, now we got to dive into that. What does that conditioning session look like? Do you just go for a jog? Well, let's probably not go for a jog, because basketball is not all jogging. There's some accelerations and decelerations. So what we would do is we would do five 3-quarter court sprints was part of that protocol, because in the NBA, people think that you run fast all the time. You can actually look at this with max accelerations. You only get like 2 to 3 of those in a game.
Right.
But we would program five because I know this is like where the practice meets the science. The data tells us that you need 2 to 3 high level efforts, and you're going to do that in a game. And I need to prepare you for that. I know you as an athlete, you're going to bullshit on like three of these because you're an athlete and that's what you do.
Right.
I've programmed five hoping I get 3 good ones. And that's kind of how we started to do it. We would just look at game data. We would look at what makes sense. You didn't play enough minutes tonight, so before practice tomorrow, you owe me some more time so we can even this thing out. You didn't get the 2 to 3 accelerations. I need that. I know you're going to bullshit on some of them, so I'm going to program 5. And then also, let's get some conditioning in, because we got to have volume of coverage, right? Basketball, you might cover up to 2 to even 3 miles in a game. Like, you know, some guys yep. get high on this stuff. But let's say 2 miles is typical. Can we create that within our conditioning? Now, I'm not going to ask you to do 2 full miles and we're not going to run straight, but we're going to create some conditioning drills that make you very tired acutely. And that's kind of how we did it. And those are both examples of, like, within a week, you might need to add volume, or within a session or within an acute time period, literally within a 24-hour period, you might have to add some stuff to supplement. There's other times, like one example, there's only been one time in my career where I actually rested. I wouldn't say I rested a player. I was outspoken about potentially reducing his risk of injury by resting him.
Mm.
And to me, this is like maybe a pat on my own back, but it's like, to me, we handled it how I think most people should handle it, because it was fair to the literature. DeMarcus Cousins was in the hot tub. We looked at acute chronic ratios after every single game because we had all that automated.
Real quick, and I can't wait for this story, just as you bring it up, though, that what you've just described perfectly is the acute chronic workload, of that idea of the, if you take that average, that normal standard chronic workload, Can you tag in on that just to kind of explain what you mean by that term? Because you just kind of explained it, but acute versus chronic, and then what happens when there's a spike?
Yeah, I mean, acute versus chronic, the ratio alone is just a number.
Yeah.
The most common number that, and I think we're moving away from it now. There's, to be very transparent, there's holes throughout this entire thing. Like, this isn't a great
thing
to use at all. But 0.8 to 1.3 is typically considered like a safe zone from an acute chronic ratio. And so how do you calculate that? You take the acute load, which is typically the week that we're in. So the most acute 7 days, you could look at today in the past 6 days, any number, call it distance. How many miles have you ran in the past 7 days? That's your acute number. Your denominator is your chronic number, which is typically the past 4 weeks. So the past 7 days, but also the past 21 days past that. So the past 28 days versus the past 7 days. You got an acute of 7. You got a chronic of 28. If you've ran, 2 miles in the past week, and you on average, call it over the past month, you would divide that by 4. So that's how you get that number.
Yep.
So it's not just a accumulation of load. You divide it by 4 to get your ratio. So if in the past week you've ran 2 miles, and on average over the past 28 days, you've ran 8, but you divide that by 4. So now that's 2. Well, now you got 2/2, and that's 1. So you would say over the past 7 days, you've ran 2 miles and you've been prepared to run 2 miles. So if we were to do that over and over, you would say that the workload is always matching the capacity.
Yeah.
You're always prepared for what you can do. That's a very simple example just for number purposes. That never happens, obviously. You always they're all over the place. And in general, if you get to like a 1.5 or above, you might say, hey, he's doing more acutely than he's been prepared to do, right? His workload is now exceeding his capacity.
Got it.
The issue there, though, is who says 1.5 is everybody's capacity, right? Like
everybody's different.
Would very much have different capacities. Maybe we have different fiber types. Maybe we have different strength levels. Maybe we have different conditioning levels. Maybe we have literally different, not only genetics, but I literally think of like where your tendons attach to the bone probably influences injury risk. Like this
anatomy
is so complicated that to me, I'm always like, okay, throw the ratio out, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's use the concept. And the concept at large is, make sure that the demand that you ask on your athlete does not exceed the capacity that they can handle. And just make sure you increase their capacity when you can, which is goes back to the gas. You got to press on the gas because we're trying to make their capacity so large that they can handle whatever you ask of them.
Yeah.
And there's good examples. We do, I think, a pretty good job here in college on it because we make sure their capacity is pretty large because we practice hard. We practice long. We have boot camps. Like, we're going to make sure our athletes are, they can handle what they're about to be asked to do. I would argue our practices are harder than our games. And in the NBA, it's typically the reverse because you don't practice a lot.
Right, right.
So, but there's only been one time where I actually rested a player.
Yeah, get us back to DeMarcus in the hot tub.
Yeah, so he's in the hot tub, and I'm looking at my reports. And, you know, I would send reports out every single night. I would send a report to our front office and to our athletic trainers.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to use a red, yellow, and green light system that a lot of people are used to. And I moved away from that even now. And what's funny is the only time our trainers used it a ton, and that I was able to get buy-in from our athletic trainers because there was the first time I did it, I added a single sentence to the bottom. And I noticed that one of our players at the time, I think it was Ramon Sessions, the number of his accelerations was up relative to his average. So I added one sentence and it was like, yo, just make sure you check Ramon's hamstrings because they may be a little bit sore. He was running faster last night than previous. That simple. Our trainer, Manny, must have read it. He comes in. Ramon comes in. I haven't even gotten the facility yet. Mon comes in, and he's manually on his hamstrings. He says, how's it feel? He said, man, I'm a little sore. And Manny runs to me. He's like, yo, Ram, that shit might work. Like,
you might be on to something. This science stuff.
Maybe, right? And so it's like, boom, we got some buy-in there. The only time I got a response from a front office member was when I highlighted a player in red and that player actually tore a calf muscle.
Wow.
An Achilles, knock on wood, but he strained a calf muscle.
Yeah.
The front office comes down. He's like, hey, Rand, like, can we talk about those reports that you always send? And it's funny because this is how the human brain works. I've been sending you reports all year and other players have been in the red all year.
Right.
that's actually a shit model. I've missed on so many players.
Right.
I've missed on 99 players. I hit on one and you want to come talk to me about the one. And that's right. Just how like the field works and the human brain works. So anyways, there was some bought in level of respect for the reporting I was doing and maybe some trust. So anyways, DeMarcus is in the red. He's literally in the hot tub. I can see him from my office because everything's got windows and all that. And I said, "Big fella, how you feeling?" "I feel like I've been hit by a truck." I said, "Man, that kind of makes sense because your numbers are kind of up." And he never cared about the data. He's like, "I know that shit got to be up." He doesn't look at it. it just so happened that our head coach, I run into him in the kitchen. We're all getting our breakfast that morning and Dave comes in. He's like, "How the guys feeling?" Because he knows I would work on reports. And half the time, I think he asked me just to be nice to like make me feel like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like,
right.
And I think a lot of our wins in our careers come from moments like that. Like, they're not necessarily these huge pre-planned things. It's almost like it was a casual conversation at the breakfast buffet line. And he said, how the guys looking? I said, "Well, I just talked to DeMarcus. He feels like shit," and which kind of lines up with some of our data. So, And he was like, "Well, why don't you come talk to me in the office real quick?" And this was right when this stuff started to take off. So he was, all the resting. He's like, "Well, you think we should sit him?" And now I'm in this position where I'm like, "Oh shit, I've never been asked this. I don't even want this decision."
Wow. And
although I'm the head strength coach, I always defer to our director of sports medicine. This to me is not my decision to make. But Dave and I have a relationship built, and I want to prove to him that I can handle this decision. So I said, "Well, coach, I don't know if that's the answer, but I think we should look at the schedule this week." And I swear I'm not making this up. It just so happened that night we're playing the Lakers on a Monday at home. On a Wednesday on the road, we're playing the Rockets. On a Friday on the road, we're playing the Memphis Grizzlies, the team that he came from. So I say, we're at home, and the Lakers weren't very good at the time. And I'm like, "I think we could beat these guys at home, coach." Memphis or Houston shoots 53s a game,
right?
Your center's not that effective.
That was the D'Antoni Rockets.
Yeah, so it's like we might get beat anyways, and it's just not an effective game for your center to run up and down the court on because they're just going to jack up threes,
right?
But if you rest them, then he's going to get a low Wednesday or low Tuesday because that's a travel day, a low Wednesday because he won't play, and a low Thursday, and then we'll be back in Memphis against your former team, who I know you want to beat, coach, and that's a bruiser game. So maybe we rest them on Wednesday, coach. He's like, "Shit, that sounds good to me." I go downstairs to Pete, my boss, because I just felt like I just kind of made a decision that I don't, should I have been making it? I don't know. And when I don't know, I usually communicate. So I go downstairs. I'm like, "Hey, Pete, me and coach just had a conversation. It wasn't planned. Like, we were just at the buffet line, and he called me into the office. He asked me if we should rest DeMarcus. I told him what I saw. This is exactly what I said. But if you think I'm wrong, like, you probably should go tell him right now because I don't want him to plan the rest of the week out." I was almost like, did I make a mistake here?
Wow.
And Pete looks back at me and he says, "Well, do you believe what you just said?" And I said, "Yeah." "Well, then why would I say anything? Let's go with it." And we end up winning at home on Monday. We got our ass kicked on Wednesday and we won on Friday. And if you go 2-1 in any given week in the NBA, you'll make the playoffs. So that's a good week. And that's the only time that I've ever rested a player.
Wow.
So you say in that moment, like, did it work? Maybe, but it wasn't a ratio that determined the decision. It was a ratio built with some subjective proponent from DeMarcus telling us how he felt with a context of a schedule and some teams. Like, there was a lot that went into those words. It wasn't like, "Hey, you're in the red, so you should rest." That to me isn't. Yep. That's not scientific or practical. That's just like being a data nerd, I guess. But So I don't know.
That's incredible. That's incredible to hear that the depth of kind of what you went through and how you navigated that whole thing. There's a lot within that to unpack. But I mean, one of the things that I really am intrigued about is how you said, and I also would put a report together, red, yellow, green, and had some attention from some coaches or from some management and not any from other staff members and of my colleagues and the athletic training room at all in some cases. But I think you're right in the sense of you said you kind of got away from the color, the traffic light system, because same thing. I mean, I would be feeling like, oh, all this information is telling me for sure I feel really good about putting this person in red. Like, I want somebody to see this because I don't like what happens after we keep them in the red for too long, all this stuff. And then nothing would happen. Yeah. And also in your case, I mean, the other side of it, as you alluded to, is, yeah, he didn't get injured that week, but we don't know. I mean, like, the injury didn't happen, so we don't know if we dodged an injury, you know? And so it worked out, but you know, the NBA, the season and this stuff is, we're picture that one case instance with DeMarcus that you described happening with 14, 16 rostered players all the time, continuously in a fluid manner. Like, there's no way that we could just sit there and rely on that one ratio to tell us, oh, yes, no, rest them. Yes, don't rest them, whatever it is. Like you said, it's a lot more that goes into those decisions. And the other side of it is, and I'm curious what your take is, okay, if we're going to rest him, though, it's not like he's just staying at the hotel and sleeping in the bed, right? Because we want to top off those tendons. We want to do some things. Maybe we do some isometrics that day with him or something like that. Curious your take on how you use those sort of you're not going to play today, but I do want to do some stuff with you to top off.
Yeah, for sure. And I always think, like, when it comes to that idea, the decrease in load, which is kind of what we just talked about, doesn't mean load needs to go to zero.
Right.
And if it does, just mathematically thinking through it, it's like, if you make that a zero, it's going to affect the ratio.
Absolutely. You're almost creating a spike for yourself.
Exactly. You certainly can. So, like, is it one day? Maybe it's a day off and that's fine, but it certainly shouldn't be a week off. Or in that case, all 3 days would not have been off, right? You got to introduce load in various areas. You mentioned, like, maybe it's some tendon work, maybe some isometrics. And the big one I always think about is, like, this idea of differentiating the system. So, it's, you know, you have a physiological system. You have a neuromuscular system. Maybe at some of you could actually say you have a muscular system alone. Mm. And so it's like, well, what systems do we need to, you know, as we think of this gas versus brake analogy, it's at one level holistic, but then at another level, it's almost like certain systems need some gas and certain systems need some brakes. And so how do we dial that in? Some real practical examples could be, hey, maybe you want to keep his conditioning up, but you want to get out of the muscle. So let's not run on the court. Let's get on some non-impact or low impact options. Maybe the bike or a rower or a VersaClimber in the pool makes more sense, because we can still get to the physiological system while decreasing the impact of that biomechanical system, right? We want to reduce muscle soreness and muscle damage, but we still want to make sure that the heart is pumping and make sure the lungs are working, right? And all of those good things. So there's so many different ways you can start to think about these things, even within, I mean, a broader level, your basketball court work. It's like,
yeah,
do you want to do more accelerations and decelerations? Maybe that's more half court work, you know, small sided games type mentality, or do we just want to get up and get the volume in? Maybe we need to go full court with some of this stuff. Maybe it's just drills. And, you know, it's all of this stuff actually flows together. It's like, once you understand the concepts, because I use this in rehab a ton. I mean, it's the same exact thing. It's like, where are we applying the gas and the brakes within rehab? It's the same within holistically the workload side. So, yeah, I think that you definitely got to differentiate that system. And it's not just, I think, a decrease. Okay, we've pulled back. What do we need to increase on? Maybe it's more recovery, right? Maybe it makes more sense to start, hey, big fella, we're going to give you a day off, but we need you to get in, you know, whatever. Maybe we're going to bring a masseuse in. You need to get a massage. Maybe we need to make sure you're not in a caloric deficit this week, because we are trying to increase your recovery output. So, like, let's add a little bit more fuel this week, but maybe it's certain types of food. So I think it's not just a simple ratio. We're not talking about a traffic light system. What we're talking about is a decision tree system that allows us to apply the gas and the brakes and then supplement all levels of this: nutrition, recovery, mindfulness. It all comes into play, because at the end of the day, the human body is affected by everything you do to it. It's not like we can say, okay, hey, we gave you a day off and now you're 100%. Like, that's not how we work.
Well, it's right. Interesting, too.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, it's great. And you mentioned earlier, you know, mood surveys, and maybe even you can put on that kind of daily survey their perception of how well they slept, right? Because to touch on an earlier point that you made with error rate with devices, is even if you have everyone, say, wearing a Whoop band or an Oura ring or whatever, which you're probably not going to get, as you mentioned, the sleep score algorithm is kind of this black box thing, and there's going to be an error rate there. And it could be someone scores a 95 and they get a traffic light system from their own personal wearable. Oh, yeah, I'm good to go today, coach. Don't worry about it. But yet they may feel like crap. Like they want to, you know, either, oh, man, I hope it's one of those days where I can sneak in that 2-hour nap in the afternoon, or there may be that disparity. So talk to us a little bit about how that subjective data may come in, either from surveys or the conversation that you had with Boogie Cousins when he's chilling in the hot tub and feeling like crap.
Yeah, to me, the most important, you know, like it's so hard to know with a lot of this stuff because there's so many things we can't really measure. And TD, you mentioned it earlier, like injuries are dichotomous. You either got hurt or you didn't. But the reality is, what we can't measure is, did you almost get hurt, but we did something to affect that?
Right.
Know that. You know, like if injury is like, you know, I don't know, 100 feet away, maybe you got to the 90th foot, but because of our programs and whatnot, you didn't get to the 100, you didn't get hurt. But we can't measure any of that stuff. And so there's so much that goes into it. So to me, the subjective part becomes more important at some level than the objective part. Mm. Only because of all the things that you've already kind of brought up with, you know, most of these systems have error rates. We don't really know how they calculate some of these with these black box type systems that they have. And on top of that, it's like, I mean, even if you have valid research on a unit, the reality is that's probably like an average across, but every single unit itself might have an error rate. In theory, the athlete would need to, I mean, it's why you would label them, right? Their monitor should be theirs, because if there is an error rate within the monitor itself, at least it's consistent, but maybe that monitor gets lost in the laundry. That's common. Now I got to switch your monitor out, right? Like I spend more time with my hand in sweaty underwear trying to find monitors than I'm like, than I want to actually say. It's just like, those are the realities we deal with. So to me, because of all of that, you can almost narrow it down to like one question. How do you feel today?
Yeah.
And as long as you have a trust and a relationship there, you should be able to pull some of that back out, right? If the guy tells you he feels like shit every day, all right, either A, you're not working hard enough because you should be eventually adapting to this stuff, or you're just lying. And then sometimes you got the other end. I work with Buddy Hield, who I love. Buddy is a workhorse. I think part of it is just like his genetics. But he would tell me like, yo, why you ask me this every day? That's how he talks super fast. I'm going to play. Like, it's my job to play. I'm going to play. No matter how I feel, I'm going to play. And it's like, man, buddy, I wish I had 100 of you. Like, you
right. Right. They're not all like that. No, that's such a good point too. And it's kind of this idea of, well, I guess I look at people that are actually implementing load management the right way. And when you give that story about how these decisions get made with you and coach at the breakfast buffet, and it goes into a meeting, and then, okay, you got to go circle back with the athletic trainer. Like it's a lot of things that go into these types of decisions that have to happen. But the organizations, the sports medicine and performance staffs that are really doing it well have a combination. It's not that they're just better at using the fanciest gadgets. They are very good at understanding what makes valid, reliable information get to them, whether it be from technology or from subjective base, finding this information from the actual athlete. And I think everyone that I've seen do it at a really high level, it is based on a foundation of that one question of going to the athlete. They know how they feel best. And yes, of course, there's going to be the knuckleheads that give you some wacky answers and stuff like that now and again, but usually you know who they are, and at least they're typically pretty consistent on their wacky answers. Yep. So it's usable information to go into this, this process of, how are we managing the loads? And to kind of cap this all off, it's not about, well, we need to get this information from either technology or subjective questionnaire style information so that we can figure out when to rest them more. It's actually, we need to understand when we need to work them and when we need to hit the gas. That is almost much more important than giving them rest. And I think it's really risky when you just lean on it to say, to use this information to tell us when to rest more because of all the things that you just explained.
Yeah, no doubt. I don't know where the NBA and these teams are at now, but that's obviously been a huge criticism. I know ESPN just recently put out a big report on it. You get to the point where it's like, are you under preparing or under cooking your athlete? And if you're under preparing them, there's a problem there for sure.
Yeah, no, it's a huge problem. And the thing that I love that you took us all the way to in this conversation is the fact, what I always look at is the load management is not there so that we can learn when or apply more rest. We just need to be able to know, it tells us when we can need to hit the gas in different areas and help. It's not about resting more. It's about when you are resting and recovering, are you resting and recovering better, more mm-hmm. precisely? So take us into that now. And we're going to kind of go reverse action, reverse engineer you back into the conversation of how you get to Lawrence, Kansas, and how you're running the Jayhawks program now. But really quick, take us into some of the recovery strategies that you help to either educate or implement with the Kansas Jayhawks men's basketball team now, versus just saying, hey, coach, we need to give them a day off so they can lay in their bed and in their dorm.
Yeah. Well, for the record, I never tell our coach here to give them a day off. that would never happen. And it goes back, to what I said earlier, there's a work capacity that we were able to develop with our guys, and not just us. I think in college in general, it was very much refreshing to come here and remember how resilient the human body can be when you appropriately apply stress and allow athletes to recover and continue on progressive overload, the things that we know are important. Like, we build some resilient athletes. And again, not just us, I think throughout the college system, because every team practice is hard. You know, I give credit to everyone for that. Recovery here is a little bit different, you know, in the league, because there's no school involved. There's charter flights involved. You pick your times. Delta Airlines caters to your team for the charter. Some teams even own their own planes. There's a lot that goes into that. It's a little bit different, right? Teams, for example, in the league may stay overnight after a road game to optimize for sleep so they can sleep in the hotel before they fly back. Some teams fly back that night. But those conversations are being had. Here, for the most part, we're going to fly back after the game, no matter what, no matter when, no matter where. Like, there's none of that. So, but we do educate on things like sleep hygiene, things like nutrition. To me, the base of any good recovery pyramid has to start with sleep and nutrition. If those two aren't locked in, like I would say, you can't massage gun your way out of bad sleep. Like, as much as I enjoy all these technologies that people think work, like, I remember, it's funny because sometimes your science and your ego gets in the way. I remember in 2013, it was the first time I saw someone put a battery pack in a foam roller. So it vibrated now.
Right.
And I remember someone showed it to me like, yo, what you think? And I was like, well, I'm not that big on foam rolling, so putting a battery in it doesn't make me much bigger on it. Right. And now these companies are worth billions of dollars. And I'm like, how stupid am I? Right. Like, damn, I should have got involved with these companies.
Right.
So I think it has to start though with sleep and nutrition. I mean, you're if you don't have those in place, then everything else is just makeup. Like,
what are some of the ways that you've been able to have some wins with players in those areas and kind of, I'm guessing, start off with little 1% kind of nibbles on the bigger stuff over time?
Yeah. You know, the word that comes to mind there is microdose. And I don't microdose our training, and I know that's a big one, but I do microdose education. Because I'm not giving 1 hour long PowerPoints on recovery to my guys. But after every lift, we have a whiteboard. It's kind of a whiteboard session. And there's always something. It's not always education based. Sometimes it's, we just lost and I'm pissed off and there's a message that needs to be had. Sometimes we had a big win and there's a good message to be had. Sometimes it's education. And so I use those moments to educate a lot around sleep hygiene, a lot around nutrition, the timing of those things, the importance of those things. And then we kind of build from there. My guys even know about workload because I talk to them about this idea of, we need to prepare your body for the demands of the sport. There's times where you're going to be sore with me in June and July. You're going to be sore in my weight room because that's our off season block. And I tell you that on day one. So that way on week two, when you feel like shit, I told you you were going to feel like this. Because I want you to know that I know what I'm doing. I've planned this for you. But the benefit is we're building a resilient body. So a lot of like the small wins just come in ways of education. You know, we have some of the things that teams have, the cold tubs. We don't have a cryo chamber, but we have Normatec and compression. We have a massage, a masseuse that can come in. But the big ones are sleep and nutrition. I educate them on sleep hygiene and have conversations around that. And then I take on a lot of our meal planning as well. So wow. I know what's at the nutrition tables. Almost every meal that we have as a team, any meal that is done the day before travel is done by our athletic trainer. But once COVID hit, he had so much going on that I took over nutrition because he was worrying about testing us every day for COVID and those things. So,
right.
So now I do all the nutrition. So I'm able to tell them when food is coming, what's going to be there, what they should probably lean towards eating more or less of. But with all that said, I mean, it's still college, right? Guys still stay up till 2 a.m. playing video games or doing whatever. They still eat Chick-fil-A. Like, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like we're perfect, but we try to do what we can within the system that we're in for sure.
That's really interesting. Just to rewind a little bit, as TD said, we've kind of joined in the dots of the journey. So, you know, you've been in California for a while. You're pretty settled as anyone could be, I suppose, in this role in the NBA. And then it seems like a previous relationship that you had again, as with earlier points in your story, comes back into play. And this NBA scout, longtime scout, Bill Pope, has a conversation with Bill Self when there's a staff change in Lawrence, and suddenly you end up pivoting again after this long tenure with the Kings, and suddenly there's a decision point to be made, or there's this crossroads in your path. Talk to us a little bit about Bill. I think there's an interesting conversation you guys had around your path in the NBA even earlier, but just maybe rewind to that, the history of that relationship, and how all these years later it had ended up with this move halfway across the country.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is now 2019, August, I think, is when the conversation started. But yeah, I had just signed, like, literally like 2 weeks before, I think I signed an extension with the Sacramento Kings. I had finished my first 3-year contract as the head guy, and then I signed the extension to go into my fourth year. Excited about that, you know, conversation with the GM. Hey, you're our guy. We love what you've been able to do with these young guys. We're developing this, and we know you're the guy for this role to keep doing this. So I was ecstatic. And I grew up, just for context, I grew up an hour from Sacramento. You know, my mom, like I mentioned, was coming to games. My family
Wow.
was coming to games. I bought my first house in Sacramento. Like, I was home, and I was ready to lock in. And, you know, the NBA is interesting because if you do a good job, maybe you could stay if you want. But I think that a lot of people, and maybe your listeners will resonate with this, we label those roles as like the pinnacle of performance sometimes. And this is not to talk bad on them at all, but I wouldn't say they're the pinnacle by any means. I will say that it was a goal of mine to make it happen. So what I was able to do that, and that was great. And if that's your goal and you're listening, like, by all means, strive for it, because you probably need to check that box off at some point. But when you do, I think your mindset changes a ton. So I get a phone call from Bill Self, Hall of Famer. I worked with Frank Mason and Ben McLemore, who played at the University of Kansas. And Bill Self, our head coach, Hall of Famer, is really close with a guy named Bill Pope, who was the scout that you mentioned. Well, I still remember, I was actually having dinner, and I get a text from Bill Pope that just says, hey, Kansas needs a strength coach. I passed your name along. Hey, thanks. I appreciate it. Gave no thought to it, so much so that I forgot about it, because I knew I wasn't leaving the NBA. But hey, I appreciate it, right? I wake up next day, go into train, get a voicemail number I don't know, click listen. Hey, Ramsey, it's Bill Self, head coach for Kansas basketball. I'm like, oh shit, okay. So I call him back, and, you know, I always say, usually when you have a big life decision coming up, before you hit that call button, if you're like me, you probably have already wrote out pros and cons. You've went through a lot of thinking. I'm not a dude that just hops on the phone. It's like, I'm going to think about this. I call him back without any of that, because I knew I was saying no. I call him back. I say, hey, coach, man, appreciate the phone call. Out of respect for you, what you've accomplished. Frank Mason, Ben McLemore, I'm returning the call, but I don't want to waste your time. Candidly, I'm not the guy for you, but I'm happy to help find you someone, but I'm not the guy. And he said, hey,
you said this to him on the phone.
On the phone, yeah. And in classic, you know, coach self mode, he says, hey, bud, you're turning me down before I offered you anything, so it might benefit you to listen. Like, you know, hey, coach, that's fair. That is fair. And said, well, I'm going to call you back in a couple of days. You know, just think through and maybe talk to some people about us. I'm like, all right, I'll do some homework. I call a few people, and I knew that they were doing their homework, because by this point, I was getting phone calls from my inner circle and then people that were really on the outskirts of even like my associates. You know what I mean? Like, they're not even people that should be. You should barely be speaking on me, but thanks for telling me you recommended me, right? Like, they were doing their homework, and credit to them for that. And, you know, a couple of days come by, and to Kansas's benefit and my benefit, my assistant, my first assistant that I hired in Sacramento, Evan Van Beesler, is from here. He interned at the University of Kansas to start his career, and he grew up 2 hours from here. And Kansas is like, this is his place. He also knows me. He knows I'm a California kid. I'm not like, if I was leaving SAC, it was like to go work for the Lakers or the Clippers. It wasn't right. And I call him and I said, Ev, you know me. I can't do the cornfields and whatever else is out there. I'm California, man. He said, Ram, it is not like that. Lawrence is beautiful. Like, you got to go get your feet on the ground. Call Frank, call Ben. They said, Ram, like, hey, man, NBA is cool, but Kansas is the best place on earth, right? Like, they love their experience here. Coach calls me back, and straightforward, super straightforward. Something that my time in the NBA made me appreciate more than ever, because as TD, you know, people aren't straightforward oftentimes in some of these roles,
yep,
these organizations. Again, not speaking bad on anyone. It's just the nature of the beast. Everyone has an ego. Everyone has an agenda. Everyone wants the next role. If you're the head strength coach, you want to be the director. If you're the director, you want to be P-roll. If you're the assistant GM, you want to be the GM. Like, that's just right. How the league works. And coach calls me. First off, it's the head coach calling me. And he's super straightforward. Hey, bud, I'm not asking you to marry us. Maybe just come date us. If you like it, stay. If you don't, go back. You know, I'm 28. He's like, you're 28 years old. You can go back. I'm like, coach, you're making a lot of sense right now. So I said, you know what, coach? I you've said enough for me to come to an interview if that's the next step of this. He said, yeah, we got to get you on campus. I fly out, interview for one day, left the next morning, flew to Maui. This is like, to me, a movie moment, you know, time in my life. And I'm staring at sunsets every day, every night. During the day, I'm taking phone calls from Coach Self and other people, you know. And now that I'm part of the recruiting process, I understand how it works, right?
Right, right, right.
But it always feels good to be wanted, right? Everybody feels good when that happens. And so as I sat there, you know, I would say when I got on the plane to come to the interview, I was like 80-20 staying in SAC. There was no way I was leaving. You were going to have to blow me away. When I got on the plane to leave the interview, I was like 60-40. I go to Maui. I stare at the sun every night. I'm enjoying my vacation. And I keep asking myself, when Coach Self first called, I asked myself, why would you leave the NBA? When I'm in Maui thinking about my life, I kept asking myself, why would you stay in the NBA? And I just kept reflecting on what do you love? What do you love about this role? And my answer continued to go back to our young players. It was like, you love the idea of building a culture or being part of a culture. You love the idea of helping these young men. You love the idea of developing them in the weight room, bigger, faster, stronger. But you also love developing them as humans, challenging them, telling them that, you know, like, I've gone at players probably harder than most people in the NBA would, because I was a young guy. I'm like, hey, man, you trying to take us to the playoffs. You can't even do 10 reps. Every time I turn around, you're cutting reps. You can't show up on time. What, you know, what are we talking about? I loved running around the weight room in SAC saying, we're going to the playoffs. What are y'all talking about? Like, that was an energy that and all my players knew that. So as soon as I accepted the role, I had so many people reach out and say, Ram, you're going to be better at Kansas than you'll ever be, because that fits you.
Wow.
And to their credit, I've been here 4 years now, and I'm so happy I made the decision to come here. And that's even while watching Sacramento play in the first round, right? Like,
sure,
I'm happy for them, and I love to see that. A good friend of mine is now the head athletic trainer there. Like, I love that, but I will always be grateful for this opportunity, because I think it changed both my career, but also like how I look at coaching and all of those things. So yeah, that was kind of the interview process and how I ended up.
Wow.
Here. Yeah.
What a story. What a process. It's a funny thing. What happens when you find the right sandbox, as I tend to call it, and it's just a fit. You can't explain it. You can't, even if it's something compared to that on paper or in many people's minds is a more pinnacle type position. As I went through a similar scenario with leaving the Lakers to go build TD Athletes Edge, and people are saying, wait a minute, you just, what? Like that's the whole thing. Isn't that the top or where the pinnacle is? And everybody's Super Bowl is different and everybody's sandbox is not the same. And so, that's you're walking it and talking it and it's a beautiful thing.
Well, I definitely appreciate it, TD. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, so many decisions, I think that we, and hopefully this doesn't happen, but a lot of times we make decisions in life based on, I think, what we think other people are going to think about it, right? Like I leave the NBA and a lot of people in my mind, I'm like, well, people are going to think I'm taking a step backwards in my career. And oftentimes what we think they're thinking isn't even accurate. As soon as I signed,
right,
like people were actually calling me saying, yo, man, congrats. I had NBA strength coaches calling me saying like, yo, you just made a big step up. I had guys like Daniel Shapiro.
Wow. Who
gave me some great advice. Daniel Shapiro said, sometimes you have to leave where you're at to be more valued. It's like, man, like all these things start to hit. So, yeah, like
so good.
Just don't make decisions in life based on what other people are going to think and find your own Super Bowl, as you said, TD.
No, that's it. That's it. I want to sort of get into, now that you've had those years of in both places, to really compare. But right now you get a lot of, like, I don't know, 18 to 20 year olds, and they're kind of indestructible in many ways. They're at that age and stage where, especially if they're maybe a freshman or a sophomore, they haven't accumulated quite so many miles and nicks and bruises along the way, that kind of thing. But you also have spent time in a weight room where you have a 39 year old veteran who's been through it all and had a surgery here or there or everywhere. And compare, contrast, kind of how you could approach some differences in preparing physically. Let's just say, for example, a 39-year-old NBA veteran versus an 18-year-old walking into your weight room for the first time that just was playing high school last year.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that example is great because I had a Vince Carter, for example, right?
Right.
In year 20. And I would say with those guys, I'm not making you bigger, faster, stronger. More importantly is availability, because that's the best ability. More important is recovering. More important is probably like lengthy warm-ups rather than thinking about let's get to the working type sets or work in general. It's like, can we warm you up for whatever's going to come? I mean, that was Vince's thing. Vince's thing was if he thought he was going to play, he would go through such a lengthy warm-up that we would train him after the game only because he would say, yo, man, I spent an hour to warm this body up. We got to use it.
Right.
You know, when those guys come into your weight room, my first conversation with Vince was, hey, Vince, man, first off, big fan. Congratulations on everything done. Excited to work with you. The second question is, what do you like to do in the weight room that makes you feel good? Because I'm not changing your script. We're going to keep doing those things. I'm not leading this. You're leading this. I'm supplementing this. I am part of your support staff here at Kansas. I'm telling my guys what I think is best for them, because in all fairness, I know more about this than they do. They don't have 20 years. They don't know what's best for them. Now, we still listen to them, right? When they tell me how their body feels,
of course.
So that's probably the biggest difference is I'm controlling. And here, you're more of an authority position. I don't treat it that way. We build relationships.
Sure.
I'm their peer. But it's definitely a different culture. It's different mindset, you know. And so that's kind of how it is for those older guys in the league. And really throughout the league in general, it's more of a peer-to-peer relationship. I want to work with you. I want to make sure that you feel good and hopefully you do what I ask, and those back and forths. Whereas here it's, I'm going to build such a strong relationship with these guys that you're going to trust everything I ask you to do. And hopefully you do it at a high level. And if you do, we now have the results that speak for themselves, right? Hey, if you do this, your vert will go up. And here's the five guys that I can show you to prove it. If you do this, you'll gain weight. These guys, you know what I mean? It's very much cut and dry. It's like, boom, this is how it's going to be done. And if you do this, I'm pretty confident it's going to work. And that's not because I think I'm a high level strength coach. It's because you're 18 years old. Your body's resilient. You haven't been around this environment. You probably haven't trained before. You probably haven't had this much access to food before. You probably haven't done this consistently for a year before. I mean, I got guys that come in that could barely do 10 pushups.
Right. So
I can confidently tell you, I'm going to make you stronger. And it's not because I'm a great strength coach. It's because you're weak. So it's totally different.
No, that's so good. It takes me to my next question, which I'm really interested in. It's a little bit more of an NBA application type of a question, because I think it probably happens a little bit more at that level than in the level where you're at right now in college at Kansas. But in the NBA, at least this would happen to me, where I'd have a really high level player who I was only going to maybe get 20 minutes in the weight room with in a whole 7-day stretch because of games, because of things that they had off the court going on. They weren't able to get to the normal time that we usually do, whatever. We had a weird flight that got bumped up. We missed our training session, and then the hotel weight room wasn't what we thought it would be, that kind of thing. It could get shrunk down. I'm guessing now you have a little bit more of a ability to kind of keep the schedule a little bit more stable, but still, I'm sure it gets pulled out from under you at times. Even now, what are you going to do with a player? And obviously, this is a really broad question, but just if you had to be really ruthless on prioritizing work in the weight room that you had 20 minutes in a week to work with a player, what kinds of things are you going to tackle for that person? If we think about it in the sense of the push the gas and top off the player for the loads of the game.
Yeah. I mean, if there's 20 minutes, which is, as you know, as you tee that up, cause that's very typical, obviously in the NBA, it's
right.
We're going to warm up with, I would say three things come to mind. Something specific to you, whether that's injury history, mobility wise, like there's going to be a movement that's going to really target you. There's probably gonna be something that's targeted for your tendons. And then there's going to be something that's probably going to warm you up for the primary lower for that day. So if we plan to do a trap bar deadlift, maybe part of your, I term them as prep packages. Your prep package is probably going to have a kettlebell deadlift or something. Like, I just want to see you flex and extend through three joints with some, through the ankles, the knees and the hips with some good technique. Some mobility, or if I know that you've had a hamstring strain, maybe we're going to do some asymmetrical leg raises with paired with, I don't know, some supine marching or something. Like, let's just wake that system up. And then some tendons, because even if you feel good now, shit, through 82 games, these knees are probably not going to like this. So let's get into those too, right? And then the movement, the workout itself, you know, the movements that we're going to get in, we're going to get a squat in, we're going to get a hinge in, we're going to get a push in, we're going to get a pull in, we're going to get a core in. Depending on how long that prep package took and some of like the banter conversations, if I have time to split that, then great. What that probably means is we're going to get either two core or a core with an arm. So you might go primary lower squat with a horizontal push and a core movement. And then we go through that 3 to 4 rounds, and then we're going to move on. Hey, that took 20 minutes. We got 10 more minutes left. Great. We still got to get our hinge in. And I always say hinge to me, like the hinge is really just posterior chain. We might be doing a supine march or a lying leg curl, but something for the posterior chain. So we might do a lying leg curl. Hey, you've done a horizontal push. Let's get our horizontal pull. Let's get an incline dumbbell row, chest supported row. And we've done some core, but I know this player, it loves their arm. So let's go get some hammer curls in. And in 20 minutes, we've knocked out everything that I feel like we needed. We've got our strength exposure, but we also have exposed to maybe some of their injury history, some of their mobility needs, and then some of those tendon needs as well. And if they want to stick around for a little bit longer, we might add some extra stuff, some fluff. But, you know, that's basically what it probably is going to look like.
Double down a little bit on the tendon stuff. What are some of your faves in terms of being able to in season load tendons? Talk for a second physiology wise, why that's important to why tendons like some load and how you do it.
Yeah. And I would say tendons are probably the first things that get pissed off when you have those spikes in load. So if you unload them, not even on purpose, if you just forget to expose them, right? Cause I think sometimes we think unloading is like this active, we're avoiding it. And I don't know, like, even if you need to consciously expose and load to these things. So, I mean, because we know they're going to get pissed off if we don't load them, we're going to try to touch them all the time. And I would say one reason, it's not necessarily gross spikes in workload. It could also be acute spikes in workload where you just for whatever reason, over a couple of days, haven't exposed this certain type of thing. Maybe it's an isometric, or maybe it's a plyometric, or maybe it's just a heavy, slow movement.
Right.
But if it's in that prep package, because they're still warming up, it's going to be some version of an isometric. So, you know, with my guys, we might do something where it's either a split squat positional hold, typically yielding. So isometrics can get broken down into two versions, and overcoming in a yielding isometric. These are typically going to be more of our yielding isometrics. Our overcoming isometrics are important, and those end up in places where I know.
Explain the difference there for us.
Yeah, so a yielding isometric is typically where you're just going to resist movement. So if you get in a split squat position, call it mid-range, and you're holding a med ball or some kettlebells, gravity's pulling that load down. It's going to try to pull you down into further flexion, and you need to yield and just hold that position. You're not going to apply so much force that you're going to stand up and move in the opposite direction. You're going to apply just enough force to stay put. And then overcoming, you're just going to apply force against an immovable object. Maybe you pin a bar into a rack and you push against it or pull it.
Understood.
So in the prep package is more yielding isometrics. And we'll do some version to get at the knees and then also the Achilles. So we might do a split squat. If we're in that split squat position, I'm probably going to cue some more shin angle that's going to get more knee over toe, because I do want to see some of that quad get going, more knee flexion. And then if we've done that in a day, then we might go rear foot elevated with an active heel elevation. So you're holding a calf raise position, right?
Killing two birds with one stone there a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes like, you can get creative, because monotony is a thing too. So, hey, I want you to hold that for 20 seconds. And then what I want you to do is stay in that rear foot elevated split squat and then bang out 10 calf raises while you're there. So we'll start to pair some of these things just to, you know, kill two birds with one stone or three birds with one stone. I mean, movements could be used a lot of different ways, as you know. So yeah, the tendon stuff will typically be yielding, typically for timed holds. And we have guys that end up loving a lot of this stuff. Like I have a really cool leg press machine that we'll use for a lot of this stuff. So sometimes we'll unload them from a vertical position and still get into the ISOs. But now the leg press is trying to push your leg back into you, and you got to hold that position. And that's still yielding. So yeah, a lot of options there.
No, that's so good. And I think, you know, these are some of the things that when I got sort of the lay of the land in the NBA and realized where are the places that we need to prioritize for them, even if they are the vets that really kind of do know their program, like they're the driver of what has worked for them. Otherwise they wouldn't have been in year 18, 19, 20, and they've developed this program. But being able to help, whether it's a rookie or a vet or somebody in between, to understand like, hey, we're getting squeezed on our time in here. I want you to hit that tendon work. I want to hit that prep package, as you said. Let's see what other time we get. Maybe coach is okay if you get out to the pre-practice work a little bit late. I can talk to somebody or whatever. Let's get an extra 10 minutes on this, that, and the other thing. It's this constant fluid. This is what I wanted to get at. This was the answer was so excellent and on point. Is constant. There's not like you sit down and you write a program for 15, 16 guys and you write that out in September and then you're going to follow this out all the way through the playoffs in the NBA or in college. From you're not going to sit down in August and write a program necessarily that's going to just fit exactly what's happening all the time for every player all the way through March Madness. So you have to have this ability to prioritize the things that they need the most to stay, as you said, available, durable, and then in the college setting, maybe work a little bit more on the bigger, faster, stronger type of stuff. If the time in the off season, as you said, is maybe more when you get to really drill down into that, make them a little more sore than in the season. But it's just this constant kind of fluid action. You're responding, reacting, seeing how much did they play last night or what's happening tomorrow or what's the travel schedule like, what's going on with this guy's injury history, communication with the training staff, with the physical therapist, all that kind of stuff. So many moving parts. And it's a pleasure to have you open up the book and share how you do it all. I want to respect the time, and this has been just an incredible conversation. I want to get to the famous final last question. This is the Basketball Strong podcast. So the question is, what does it mean to you to be basketball strong?
Oh, so, you know, I've read that when you guys sent it over, and I'm like, man, what does that mean? You know, a few things come to mind, though. First one is like, are you strong enough to guard your position? And then offensively, are you strong enough to get to where you need to go on the floor? Because there's really good players can make a shot from anywhere. But to me, basketball strong means that you are taking your shots or getting to your positions where you want to go. The defense isn't moving you. You're going there. And there's obviously skill component there. But that those are both ends of that. And then basketball strong further is this durability, because I do think strength is a foundation of durability. Are you strong enough to handle the toll of a season? For us, you know, it's up to 40 games. And in the NBA, I mean, what, 82 plus potentially, I don't know, if you were to go four rounds of game sevens, I mean, you're up there, right? 100 games, 100 plus games.
Right.
That's part of the question. You're not basketball strong if you end up burning out by January. You're just strong, I guess. So to me, those things come to mind. You need to be strong on both ends of the floor, and you need to be able to handle the demands of the sport, which to me, longitudinally, can you last an entire season, if not further? I mean, you look at Steph Curry last night, and I know there's been a lot of articles written about how strong he is, and maybe he is, but he's certainly not that big of a player.
Right.
But he put up 50 in a game seven. I think he's basketball strong.
Yeah.
Right? So, it has less to do with what you look like and probably more so to do with the things that we talked about there.
Yeah, I mean, that's pure gold. Phil, get that in the vault, baby.
Locked.
You bring up Steph Curry, and it is people forget he really struggled with durability early in his career, before he was able to really accept the weight room, and knowing some of the people that were early on in his career at Mike Roncarardi and KK Lyles, who were really in the early stages of his career before they became the dynasty that we see now, and what he did, he really had to kind of learn to incorporate and weave in and embrace the weight room. And we did, we saw his body change, but we also saw his durability change significantly. So the points you make there are great. I do want you to take us through what I've just really enjoyed learning about and seeing the stuff that you're putting out there to help people educate and do what you have a passion for of always learning and getting better and improving, advancing our craft, basically, which is what you've done through the APCC, the Applied Performance Coach Certification. Take us into that.
Yeah. I mean, this thing has turned into this, a community of coaches, and fully transparently, like I wouldn't say I'm great at business. I mess up all the time. I just had a huge blemish the other day. I mean, I was live streaming and didn't know I was live streaming as I was trying to get people into a webinar. Like, I don't know what, I would never claim to be good at the business side at all. But the community that we've been able to grow through this is just amazing. It's fundamentally what it is I call it a sport performance masterclass. There's 8 weeks live. There's 4 weeks on demand. There's like five bonuses in there. It's a whole bunch of content, everything relevant to what you'll be asked to do as a performance coach. Because, you know, as you get further in your career, and like the conversation we had today becomes very much like, you know, not so much the nuts and bolts. We didn't talk sets and reps that much. Right. And that's not really because there's at some level for us, like, hey, that's not that fun to talk about anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I always say you need to be damn good at those things if you want to achieve success in the field.
That's right.
But that to me is the bare minimum. Like, just because you're good at that doesn't mean you're going to find success. You better be good to even start play in the game. So fundamentally, that's what it is. It's conversations around. We go through 12 unique but comprehensive topics. Evidence-based practice kicks us off. We go strength, hypertrophy, power. Workload is a big part of that. Return to play, recovery, speed, agility, quickness. I mean, all the things that you expect a performance coach to be able to do, we're gonna talk about, and we're going to have readings and all of that. But that's not what makes it special, because I'm very transparent about that. You can – anything you learn from me, you can learn for free online. YouTube is there for you. Like, so what we do, and I think through the course, we accelerate that learning curve. You can basically do it all on your own. It's probably going to take years, or you can do it much faster with me over an 8 to 12 week period. But much more important than that now is the community, as you know, maybe you've seen online, but we have like 20 coaches in the NBA now. A lot of these coaches weren't in the NBA before they started.
Amazing.
I'm looking for 2 G League coaches right now to help some guys get some roles. And we're now at a point, an NBA team just hired a guy, and the guy that is hiring him was an APC coach. Like, it's just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. To me, that payoff is so incredible. I don't know, like, part of, you know, I think a lot about my values, and one of my values is legacy. And for the industry at large, I do want to leave it in a better place than I found it. And what does that mean, right? That's so abstract. And for me, it's like, I don't know, pay it forward, help people. If I can help somebody reach their goal, shit, someone helped me, lots of people helped me. And I know how I feel about those people, right? I know I'm indebted to those people, and I feel a respect for them. And so I think that's so much more important now. It's like, we got people freaking achieve. There was 3 guys on the first cohort. There was 3 guys a month after they emailed me and said, hey, coach, we're just really struggling with kind of the career side and all of that. But you might hop on a Zoom. And I hop on a Zoom. And I think sometimes when you do this, people expect some like groundbreaking information, right? But like, that's not out there. Most of the time it's stay the course, stay positive. You got to pay your dues and it will pay off. And I basically give them a version of that. And you fast forward a year later and 2 of them are in the NBA and 1 of them left the NBA to go take on a big time college role. And it's just like, yo, that's crazy, man. That's crazy. So
that is
so much more important than the course, but it is a huge passion project of mine.
No, it's incredible. And it's landed itself right on the very top of my list of when people ask me, hey, if I wanted to climb a ladder and work myself into a position and set myself up to be able to work with elite athletes and specifically basketball in many cases, but how do I do that? It's like, this is definitely one of those resources where it's really quickly become like, this is just a no-brainer. You can't even think twice about this. Because I think when you and I came up and through, it was sort of that tipping point of where the field and the position of a strength coach or a performance coach, or the term gets batted around a bunch, but what that position really entails was very, very, very different when we very first broke in. And things have changed really fast. And a lot of that is based on evidence, research, and information of how we need to be more precise of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And then, yes, you need to have exceptional soft skills of being able to connect with people and being able to do all the stuff you just walked us through of a master course of that. But you really have to be sharp in these aspects of technical application of what we're doing for these players, because the expectation is there now. And that's a great thing, because our profession didn't used to have that much of an expectation. Like you said, there wasn't even an assistant strength coach in Sacramento before you got there. I didn't have an assistant strength coach with the Lakers for 5 of my 6 years. Like, we're being taken seriously more. This is one of those things that helps us to do that and helps individuals to be taken more seriously and be more credible and ready for the new version of the position. So credit to you, sir. It's a huge part. And yeah, that's what you're doing. You're leaving the profession better than when you found it. And that is what legacy is about. So appreciate you for it.
Man, thank you so much. It's always good to hear things like that, but it means a ton coming from a guy who, I mean, like, we take full circle to the start of this. I literally had a cup of coffee with you like over a decade ago. And to be on this even now, it's an honor, and I appreciate y'all, but those words mean a lot, TD. I appreciate that.
No, it's my pleasure, and it's the truth. Tell people where we can follow, where we could tap in, whether it's what you're putting out there through different channels, whether it's specific to the APCC, everything.
Yeah, so Instagram is dr.ramsey.nijum. Twitter is just Dr. Ramsey Nijum. Not that active on Twitter. I need to be better about that. And then applyperformancecoach.com has everything as far as the course goes.
So good. Thank you, sir.
Man, thank you guys. Thank you both of you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's show, and we hope you did, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. And so you never miss a weekly episode, be sure to subscribe and follow. You can find previous episodes on our show website. That's www.basketballstrongpodcast.com. For more basketball performance resources and nagging injury solutions, follow me on Instagram at TDAthletesEdge and follow Phil at PhilWhiteBooks. Until next week's episode, stay basketball strong.